What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Liam Fox and welcome to Pacific Review. We'll take a look at the big stories from the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up, the Solomon Islands leader who gained international attention for his opposition to the Chinese government. New Caledonia tries to get a handle on its gun problem. And excitement, anticipation and pride in Brisbane ahead of the Polynesian Derby in the Pacific Rugby League Championships. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This program is brought to you from the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people. First, Papua New Guineans are celebrating the canonization of their first saint during a special mass at the Vatican. Saint Peter Torots was a layman who taught the Catholic faith in the face of repression from occupying Japanese forces during World War II. PNG reporter Belinda Cora filed this report from his home village, where proud locals gathered to witness the historic occasion.
From the Vatican to the small village of Rakunai in East New Britain province, hundreds of people gathered in Peter Torot's home village to watch Pope Leo XIV proclaim him a saint during a live stream from St. Peter's Square. In the crowd were locals and Catholics from around the country who travelled here to witness the historic occasion.
Many times we heard all saints, some saints, but they are from outside. But this is the first Papua New Guinean local man, and I'm really, really happy.
I'm feeling very high. It's something that the people, especially from Rakuna area and people of East New Britain, and I think Papua New Guinea have been looking forward to it.
After all the sacrifices that we have been going through and praying all this time, all these years, for this day to come, and we are all happy.
A layman, Peter led this parish during the Second World War after Japanese occupiers took away the local priest. He continued to teach the faith and uphold the sanctity of marriage in the face of Japanese repression and an attempt to reintroduce the practice of polygamy. It was that commitment that got him arrested and reportedly killed by lethal injection in 1945 at age 33. 80-year-old Carola Namiao was the last person St. Peter Torot baptized before his death.
I do feel the presence of Peter Torot in my prayers and in my life. I am thankful to him for his guidance. I don't forget him. I know he is here and strengthens me in my prayer life.
Altogether, Pope Leo XIV canonized 7 men and women during this special mass. Peter Torot's journey to sainthood has taken 20 years, ever since Pope John Paul announced the first step in 1995. Pope Francis confirmed his canonization last year following his trip to PNG during the final months of his ministry.
Belinda Cora reporting from Rakunai Village. A Solomon Islands politician who gained prominence for his vocal anti-China stance is being remembered as a canny and principled leader after his death earlier this week. The former Premier of Malaita Province, Daniel Swidani, attracted national and international attention for opposing the national government's decision to switch diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China in 2019. He maintained ties with the Taiwanese government afterwards and banned Chinese companies from his province while in office. Journalist and researcher Ed Kavanagh interviewed Mr. Swidani several times for a book on the diplomatic switch and says he leaves a lasting legacy on the international stage.
Daniel Sedani was, you know, a bit of a contradiction in some ways. So I interviewed him very soon after he'd become, you know, very famous, basically, for taking this stance against China. He had alleged that he'd been offered a $1 million bribe or something of that effect to support China rather than Taiwan. And he sort of very publicly and very famously rejected that. So by the time that I'd met him, he was, you know, very high profile. He was in the news everywhere. And he had a very large personality in that domain. But when you actually met the man, he was very quiet. He was very humble. He was pretty soft-spoken. And he wasn't, you know, enormously charismatic like you might see with some of these big, bombastic, you know, big men Pacific Island political figures. So he was, a quiet man, but he was very principled. And I think people resonated with that personality.
And how would you describe his leadership? Like, was Mr. Suidani a radical, a Democrat, or something else?
Look, I think he was a very deft politician. He didn't come across as a radical. He didn't seem, as I said, like he was bombastic and, you know, outlandish or anything of that nature at all. But he very savvily, him along with his team, tapped into the very legitimate concerns that his community had with that China switch. You know, the people of Malaita did have a very deep and loyal relationship with Taiwan. So there was certainly that. But the China switch also became a bit of a proxy for Malaitans being left out of the big national conversation, the big national decisions. And so I think Daniel Sedani instinctively saw that his population were skeptical of this switch, and it was a political opportunity for him to demonstrate some leadership. And I do think he believed in the issue as well.
And is that where you think his opposition to the Chinese government largely stemmed from?
Yeah, well, there was that innate concern within the community of Malaita itself. There was also some really sophisticated organising of protest groups and Malaita nationalist groups that soon after the switch happened, they really rallied. There was an organisation called Malaita for Democracy that popped up at a very similar time to Daniel Sedani starting his premiership. And they were very effective in pressuring Daniel Sedani into a very anti-China stance. Now, I think Daniel Sedani supported many of those measures, but it wasn't just his own personal view that sort of pursued that approach. It was certainly a reflection of the campaigns that we were seeing in Malaita, and particularly from this campaign group, Malaita for Democracy.
What was the impact when he came out and sort of, you know, said publicly that he'd said no to a $1 million bribe? I mean, that's a big thing to say publicly, whether it's true or not. What kind of impact did that have, I guess, on his profile and with the way that the government responded to that?
Well, what he effectively did in that moment was appoint himself as the de facto opposition leader. You know, the China switch issue had been actually bubbling away for years, but there hadn't really been a clear dividing line or characters on either side of that debate. And he became the absolute figure that was saying, no, we want to go in a different direction. And he was even flirting, you know, very, very subtly in some ways with Malaita becoming its own country. You know, he entertained a republic referendum and all this sort of stuff, and saying that he'd go with Taiwan, the rest of the country could go with China. So he positioned himself as the pro-democracy, the anti-China leader, in direct opposition to Manasseh Sogavare, who then he could paint as, you know, basically a China proxy.
And how much division, did this stoke within the country?
I think it didn't exaggerate divisions, but it sort of exposed the current divisions that are there and remain there. And that's largely for historic reasons and because of the nature of Malaita's role within the broader country. Malaita is the largest province in Solomon Islands. It's got about 250,000 people on the island, but about half the national population are Malaitans. And for a very long time, they've felt omitted and excluded from the center of power and from, you know, the heart of decision making in government. And so when the government sort of flicked a switch, you know, and went to did the biggest foreign policy decision in the country's history, really without any consultation, that really irked people in Malaita. It reflected the existing divisions that they saw. So I think it was just fertile ground for people that genuinely were worried about China to voice that concern, but also those who have for a long time been worried about Malaita being left out to really play that card.
Do you think his position and the attention it focused on Malaita will have a lasting impact?
Yeah, I think what is remarkable about this man is that, you know, you and I would very rarely speak about a subnational politician in the Pacific on the radio, you know, thinking about their legacy. It is extraordinary that you know, a man of that type of office was able to elevate himself into national and international prominence. So there's always going to be now, I think, a bit of a legacy of him as the bulwark against China. There's a global community of people that are anxious about China that see him as a hero. And then there's that more mixed reputation within the country itself. He obviously alienated a lot of people within Honiara, within the government there. There's some mixed views even within Malaita.
That's journalist, researcher and CEO of the think tank Mackell Institute, Ed Kavanagh, speaking to Kyle Evans. In New Caledonia, the historic tension between the indigenous Kanak people and the descendants of French colonial settlers is one of the factors driving high gun ownership. The French Pacific Territory is one of the most heavily armed places in the world outside of a war zone, second only to the United States. The presence of so many weapons helped to fuel the deadly violence during riots that devastated the capital, Noumea, last year. Now, a system is being rolled out to make the acquisition of weapons more secure, as Kyle Evans reports.
Like many in New Caledonia, Emmerich Sakajan grew up with a gun in his hand.
In the north of New Caledonia, when I was like 12 years old, I used to go with my friends, you know, in different property. This is the way I've learned how to use the guns.
These days, he's a filmmaker and boxing coach in New Caledonia's capital, Noumea. He no longer hunts, but he rarely leaves home without a gun, especially after deadly riots swept through Noumea last year.
I wear my gun as a concealment. I'm not that kind of guy who's going to use the gun for no reasons. But even though I still have my gun on my wrist, I'm just walking down the street and I feel comfortable and I feel secure. I feel safe because I have a gun. You know what I'm saying?
He's not the only one. Almost one out of every two people own a gun in New Caledonia. Estimates show there could be as many as 128,000 unregistered firearms in the country, on top of the 64,000 that are registered. It was hoped a new registration system would make the acquisition of weapons more secure. But much like the territory's political situation, reform efforts have so far been ineffective.
There were situations in New Caledonia who forced the registration to change toward the firearms. And since then, some people just hidden their guns. Some people didn't declare that they had a gun, or they just simply declared the gun like stolen gun, whereas they may not be stolen, you know? You know what I'm saying?
The registration system he's referring to is called the Weapons Information System, or SIA. It was implemented by the French High Commission and is designed to track purchased weapons over the course of their lifespan by digitising administrative procedures relating to the trade, acquisition and possession of the gun. It will also introduce a mandatory safety exam for firearm purchases and make it so hunters need to join a rifle club before buying ammunition.
It's a weapons information system that is designed to ensure the traceability of arms within New Caledonia, as well as bringing New Caledonia in line with not only French regulation, but European regulation.
That's Sheridan Ward, researcher on non-militarisation and countries without sovereign military institutions. She's conducted various research projects across the Pacific and wrote about the new system for the Lowy Institute.
It's a much newer and cleaner system as well, and it should hopefully be adapted more towards the New Caledonian context, making it easy and accessible for weapons dealers and armories to input information into there, as well as have more comprehensive information about that weapon so that it can be tracked throughout the entirety of its life cycle.
However, the system has only been partially deployed since its rollout in 2019 due to administrative holdups and political upheaval in France. It means most of the territory still operates under the old registration system, which has seen only 5,000 weapons registered over the last year. Meanwhile, in areas where the system has been implemented, Ms. Ward says it's received pushback for making guns too hard to obtain.
When you have all of these extra barriers, particularly mandatory hunting safety exams, the need to present a birth certificate, membership to a rifle club, just creates barriers from people actually wanting to go in and do the right thing and go through the legal avenues. There's also other restrictions that mean that if you are to transfer a gun from one person to another, you're not actually allowed to do that just between friends or family, but you are supposed to go into a gun shop and do that within the presence of a registered gun trader. The result from that means that people are completely detached from this formalized system, and there's no incentives to be a part of it. Many of the Kanaks that I've interviewed out in the provinces just find it a bit ridiculous that this is so inaccessible for them, and there's really no benefit to them to go into the city and go into a registered gun trader, especially if we're looking at, you know, passing guns between family members for genuine hunting purposes. These extra barriers, if they're not done with benefits, are just going to push more people away from going through the legal avenues and into the black market.
According to Ms. Ward's research, black market sales of firearms have risen since the closure of several armories, which shut their doors after the riots.
One third of all licensed armories have actually shut down permanently in New Caledonia, in part because of this shutdown of licensed armories, as well as looting that happened during the riot. I've been told that there have been many more stolen weapons appear in the black market.
There are ardent gun owners like Emrik Sakarjan who believe guns should be harder to obtain.
I think it is a good idea because a firearm still is dangerous. I know there's a lot of crazy people, especially in New Caledonia. People are really aggressive. We are aggressive. I have a lot of rage myself in my heart about what happened in New Caledonia. You know, I'm really angry. And every time I go into Australia or I go into New Zealand or another country, I feel safe. I can walk down the street. You know, I feel really comfortable. But in my own country, I don't even feel comfortable. I feel angry every time.
Emirat Sokajan ending that report from Kyle Evans. It was World Polio Day on Friday, a time to reaffirm the global commitment to stamping out one of history's most devastating childhood diseases. While much of the world is polio-free, it is far from gone. In Papua New Guinea, health authorities are racing to vaccinate children amid an outbreak of the disease that's caused 3 cases of paralysis so far. With only half of all children fully vaccinated, PNG is facing the stark reality that low routine immunisation coverage means epidemics are not just possible, but probable. The Burnet Institute is one of the organisations helping the PNG government contain the outbreak, but its country director, Dr. Frederick Charles, says it's a huge task.
The first was a 4-year-old unvaccinated child from Lae, Morobe province. Most recently, WHO confirmed 2 additional cases in children who experienced paralysis as well. One from the central province. The child didn't have any unclear vaccination status. Another one from Anga, who had received 0 doses. So both cases are genetically linked to the initial Lae wastewater detection, indicating that the virus has spread beyond its original point of detection. So in total, there's been about 47 environmental detections across 5 provinces. That includes Port Moresby, Lae, Mount Aigen, Goroka, and Mede.
To that vaccine-derived poliovirus type 2, what does that mean, and what happens to someone who gets it?
So basically, it means that it's a mutated form of the weakened virus that's used in the polio oral polio vaccines. In the communities with low vaccination coverage, the virus can circulate and mutate, regaining the ability to cause paralysis. It's quite rare, but dangerous, in fact. Even fatigue and in severe cases, they can experience irreversible paralysis. The recent case in central and Anga province in PNG just shows that the virus is spreading silently, and that's why high vaccination coverage is very critical at the moment.
And so it is low vaccination coverage that allows something like this to happen, this type to develop.
That's correct. So in PNG, about 50% of the children in PNG receive their full set of childhood vaccines. The root cause include limited access to health services, vaccine stockouts, lack of trained staff, and also low public awareness. Some facilities don't offer routine immunization at all. But at Burnet, we are working with the government to address some of these gaps through the Zero Dose project that we do in PNG, which identifies children who have never been vaccinated and work to remove some of the barriers, whether it be transport, staffing, or community engagement.
What are the next steps, immediate steps, that need to be carried out to bring this under control?
So Bennett, as well as all the health partners, ENPNG, are supporting the national immunization campaign by training healthcare workers, strengthening the cold chain systems, and helping with the community mobilization. The first round of supplementary immunization activity, it began in August, and it's ongoing across 17 provinces now. The second round began on the 29th of September. So with the virus that's now confirmed in multiple provinces, we are urging all the partners to push for more than 95% coverage. Ideally, 100%, but challenging. But 95% coverage, if we can achieve it, that may stop the epidemic.
Looking ahead, what does success look like in the campaign against polio in PNG over the next 12 to 18 months?
So success means actually stopping the transmission of the virus itself, reaching at least 95% of the children with the polio vaccine, and also looking at strengthening routine immunization systems that we have in the country. It actually means no new cases, robust surveillance, and communities that actually understand and support immunization. With strong leadership, community engagement, and support from partners like WHO, UNICEF, and Gavi, we can make PNG polio free again.
Dr. Frederick Charles from the Burnet Institute. Finally, Polynesian pride will be on full display at Brisbane Suncorp Stadium on Sunday night when Samoa and Tonga clash in the Pacific Rugby League Championships. It'll be the first time the sides have met since the 2022 World Cup quarterfinal in England, when Samoa got home by just 2 points. In the build-up to the big game, Samoan supporters turned out in their thousands to greet the players at a fan day in Brisbane South. Richard Hewitt has the story.
Just a small flavour of what to expect from the Samoan fans when their team locks horns with Tonga, although some of the side's younger followers might not make it to Suncorp.
I run a family daycare. These are my family daycare kids. So we just finished school and they all want to come here. So luckily I've got tickets from my sister-in-law that I have be able to bring the kids here to enjoy this experience. Aloha!
Meanwhile, in the merchandise line, some tough decisions were being made.
So you have to buy food. We got kids here. We got flags we spend a lot of money on. So yeah, I'm just standing in line and my wallet is pretty shaking at the moment. But my daughter wants a jersey.
I definitely need a hat. It's so hot outside. So I definitely need one of those. And then a couple of shirts. It's almost Christmas, so I may as well buy some gifts while I'm here.
But it's what happens on the field that is of most concern to the Samoan camp, and the side is under pressure. Coach Ben Gardner, yet to win after 5 attempts despite his star-studded lineup, but veteran player Josh Papali'i is upbeat after the narrow loss to New Zealand a week ago.
When BG's running it, there's definitely that detail around video and training sessions, a lot more clarity to getting things done to help us play well. I felt like in the past we were good but not great, and that's one of BG's sayings. Anyone can be good, but being great's even better. So I feel like even the leaders that's in camp at the moment, you know, we have Payne on board, Jerome Bizza Jr. just makes the squad and the team a lot better.
And Fetu Samoa have a job to do to avoid being sucked into a relegation battle, and that's topple Australia. The side should be hurting after throwing away a 20-point lead against the Kiwi Ferns last time out. But Jasmine Fongavina, who would be in the Samoan squad but for injury, was at the fan day to support her teammates and putting a positive spin on things.
I think they did good, really good. Like, I feel like they're the underdogs of the comp at this point. And yeah, I reckon they killed it. They did better than I think everyone thought they would. And it's good to be like part of the culture and the camp.
Star of the show for Samoa against New Zealand was 18-year-old Shalom Sawaso from the Brisbane Broncos and the Rugby League Players Association's Rookie of the Year.
Honestly, emotions are everywhere. There's emotion of like how proud I am of my family and my village for pushing me through. I'm feeling happy that everything that I've built up to has paid off for my little family group. So I was super blessed for them to come all the way down.
A And if the crowd at the fan day needed any further revving up, they got it when the Dolphins' Hamiso Tambuai-Fidao put in an unexpected appearance to announce his decision to jump ship from Australia and make his return to the Toa Samoa camp for the World Cup next year. Josh Papali'i was already in on the secret.
Yeah, Jeremiah, Tino as well, and Hammer. And I think we did one sauna session together and we were just talking about where we would play for World Cup. And Hammer was like, I'm going to come back. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll believe when I see it. And jumped on the team bus, come from home to make his announcement in front of thousands of Samoans. And it was such a surreal feeling.
So the Hammer will be in Samoan blue again, but not until next year. Right now, his future teammates have to topple the Tongans to ease the pressure on their coach and give themselves a chance of making the Pacific Championships final.
Richard Ewart reporting there. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Liam Fox. Thanks for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.